Civil rights legend and educator Ruby Sales will be at the Rose Center in Rome, Massachusetts, in a program titled Where Does It Hurt? Overcoming the Pain of White Supremacy. The session will be made up of soul-searching conversation on white supremacy and systematic oppression to come away with a radical new spiritual perspective on the tasks before us. Ruby Sales believes that all Americans are hurt by a racist system that continues to oppress people of color. For this nation to survive, she says, we must forge new ways of honestly talking about how this brutal reality affects whites as well as blacks. A new language is needed, she says, that incorporates not only our outrage at the harm that has been done, but also a vision of love through which we could become a new people, the America still waiting to be born. It is a great pleasure to welcome Ruby Sales to the roundtable this morning. What an honor to have you on the program. Thank you very much for being with us.
Good morning, and thank you very much for inviting me to be on this program. And what an honor it is for me to sit in the seat with you this morning.
Well, thank you. Your program that you'll be doing at the Rose Center, again, is titled Where Does It Hurt? Overcoming the Pain of White Supremacy. I assume that this is the culmination of work that you have been doing your entire life.
Yes, well, it certainly is rooted in my observation of white supremacy, both as a victim and also as a historian, and most recently as a public theologian, and really looking at the harm that white supremacy did to Southern whites as much as the harm that it did to African Americans, and really understanding that we must begin to create a new discourse where that places white people directly in the struggle to eliminate white supremacy, not in terms of something that they do for people of color, but something that they do to redeem themselves from the stranglehold and the rigid historical rigidity of white supremacy.
So let us start at a baseline, a place where we can all begin, and that is with I think this is common sense, but I'm hoping you can provide us just with a baseline definition of white supremacy, of what that is.
Yes, white supremacy is a systemic way of organizing institutions and creating a culture that privileges white power and white hierarchies over people of color and our institutions and our culture. So it's really a system. It's an organized system that privileges, that creates a false construct of whiteness and creates and privileges that construct of whiteness.
Given that you have been a part of the civil rights movement for decades, I'm curious as to what improvements you have seen. It seems that in your work that the old adage of every step forward, there are many steps back. And I'm curious as to where you think we are now and the glimmer of hope that we can see for the future.
Well, I think that it's really important for us to understand that where we are today is a culmination of 40 to 50 reactionary policies of Republicans and dog whistle politics to overturn the gains of popular movements in the 60s and 70s that destabilized white supremacist Southern WASP power, and that it has been operating in every aspect of Republican politics in the last 40 years. And so that means that this resentment started out with words like Patrick Buchanan's The Moral Majority, which was to imply that people who were not a part of that, who were people of color or dissidents, were immoral people, or the Silent Majority, which meant that the rights that black and brown people and women gained silenced the rights of white people. On and on and on, we see this build up, and the whole notion of taxes, cutting taxes, really was a dog whistle message created by Lee Atwater that suggested that black people, because of the Great Society programs that Lyndon Johnson created for people in this country. The assumption was that black people were benefiting from these programs off the tax dollars of white people, and therefore the strategy was to cut taxes and not have white people subsidize lazy black people, cut taxes, and that meant cutting those programs that lazy black people, like welfare queens and big black buck fathers, as Ronald Reagan described us, would no longer fester and live off the backs of white people. So this has been, and in addition to that, in addition to the dog-whistling racist politics, they have also been trying to undermine the social gains of the New Deal and also the movement that FDR moved this country from a corporate state where corporations control the apparatus of power in this country to a democracy where the people were essential to the instrument of democracy. And so where we are today represents years of work of Republicans to reestablish white supremacy in a corporate state in America. We're also in a militarized society where the greatest part of this weaponry is directed towards people of color. We see that manifest in the criminalization of immigrants of color and using federal agents to round them up and to kick them out of the country and to make sure that they do not come into the country. That is tied into a conversation that began in the 1990s where it was made clear that by the year 2000 this country would be predominantly colored. And so America set itself on a course to whiten America, and we can see that manifested in all kinds of policies the policies towards kicking brown and black immigrants out of this country and making sure that immigrants from brown and black countries are not allowed to come into this country. In addition to that, gentrification, which is whitening American cities. So we're in a very, very troubling period of American history where we are under the auspices and the power of white supremacist culture warriors who are part of a global movement that includes Putin in a rapidly developing majority colored world to make sure that the efficacy and the hegemony of white supremacy maintains itself by any means necessary.
Ruby, let me ask you this question. You used in your beautiful answer a moment ago a couple of times the word dog whistle and dog whistle politics. The idea of that, of course, is that it's something that most can't hear except for the people that it's intended for. Although, doesn't it seem that in the current administration and in the current climate that we're in, that it isn't a dog whistle? It's being said loud and clear from the Oval Office.
Well, I think it is still both. I think it's not an either or, it's both. When he talks about Chicago as being a disaster and a violent space, that's a dog whistle politic that says something about the black community and black people as being urban animals. And so some of that, yesterday when we heard Grassley talking about working class people do not need tax breaks because they'll spend the money on whiskey and movies and women. Yeah. That was a reiteration of Ronald Reagan's assault on black people and welfare queen mentality. So we still dog whistle politics, although I will agree with you that the language has become more and more direct, but it is also still coded language.
I guess my concern is that it's becoming less, it's more overt. And with that, overtness becomes an acceptability that many of us find not only frightening but haunting.
Well, I don't think it's the language that makes that possible. I think when we ask the question, why is it that the Republicans keep raising up the name of Obama and Hillary Clinton? by doing that, they hope to feed into the collective sense, the collective white supremacy that is a part of many white Americans. And so to raise up Obama stirs up that fear that white people have that for black rights means less white rights. And the same thing with Hillary Clinton in terms of a dog whistle around misogyny. So I think that it's not just the language, it's also feeding into old fears and old angers and old irrational senses of being victims, white people feeling like they're being victimized by other. And so that I think that this is the genius of what they're doing, and whether they ever dog whistle or not, I think the mere fact that they find a way of feeding into these residual fears and this residual sense of that this is a white country, and in order to make this country great again, you must take away the rights of people of color and even take away the rights of women and the rights of LGBTQ people and turn this country back over to WASP male supremacists.
So how do we remove that residue, remove the residual effects? Because that language, no doubt, is being used, coded and uncoded, but it is also being listened to and acted upon. So how do we stop that?
Well, first of all, I think that we have to stop demonizing. Demonizing each other does not allow us to really deal effectively with the problem. We must begin to have white people understand that white supremacy is not a privilege, that it is a death sentence that diminishes their humanity, that makes them afraid to live on the land and destroys their ability to live on the land with other people. It contains them in very small, segregated spaces where they are afraid to allow anyone to come into those spaces. It creates in them an absolute rage against others, and always seeing the world, as Richard Hofstadter, the historian, said, from the position of the enemy within and the enemy without. And these are the kind of issues that I will be dealing with as we talk about white supremacy at the Rose Center, December 7th through the 8th, because I think that until white people begin to understand that they too have suffered from the moral injury of racism, and that it has diminishes the part of them that is fully human. No one wants to give up a privilege, but once people understand that they're in the grip of existential death, then I think people are more prone to want to change.
So you have this spiritual perspective that I know is going to be a part of what you're going to be talking about at the Rose Center. And this, the title, as I mentioned, Where Does It Hurt? Overcoming the Pain of White Supremacy.
Yes.
Talk to us about that spiritual perspective and how we can implement that as a way of working our way forward.
First of all, white supremacy, misogyny, heterosexism, all forms of oppression represent spiritual malformation and social pathology that diminishes our relationship with each other, God, and all aspects of creation. And what movements do is that they take us from the low valley consciousness into a higher level of consciousness where we begin to transform our values, where we begin to enlarge our perspective. Hello?
Yes. Yeah, you're still on with us.
Where we begin to enlarge our perspectives in terms of how we look out and see the world, and we begin to rebuild a different society that is more relational and that not only humanizes other but humanizes ourselves in the process. So I think that until we understand the pathological implications of systems of oppression, we will always cling to these systems as being the norm.
So, I'm interested in the approach that you.
Oh, let me just say one thing.
Yes.
So the alternative to that empire consciousness is movement consciousness, And what movement does is that it moves people to a higher level of consciousness, and it offers a pathway of redemption, not only for the perpetrator of the injustice, but also for the people who've been victimized by the oppression. And it creates an authentic process towards redemption, which begins with, first of all, an analysis of what is the harm. Secondly, the ability to say that I'm sorry for having created the harm. And then thirdly, to set about to actively, in conversation with the person that you've harmed, to talk about ways in which that might be repaired. And then you move from the reparation of that harm to the restoration in community, where we become one with each other in community. And finally is the ultimate state of resurrection, where a new society is created. So there are steps to become, there are authentic steps to working through the historical bondage of oppression.
When you look at what you're going to be working on and accomplishing over this time at the Rowe Center, what are the ingredients that need to be in place for you to have a discussion that allows? I mean, obviously, you mentioned part of it, that there has to be an understanding, and then there has to be the work that we all need to do. And I'm curious as to how that manifests itself in the exercises that are done to bring us to that, for want of a better term, although it probably is a pretty good term, enlightenment.
Well, I think first and foremost, one has to come with a hopefulness and a belief that we're not captives of history, that we have the agency and the power to change our lives as well as change society. That is first and foremost important, because by having that level of hopefulness and believing in the possibility of human transformation and change, we break through the psychological and the spiritual bondage of moral nihilism. And we move away from a death-driven society where we are enshrined in a never-ending system and web of oppression, anger, and hatred, into a different relationship with each other that is life-affirming, that not only enhances my life but the lives of other people. And so that the first step is to be committed to that sense of hope. The second step is to engage with text and films and other media that began to show the ways in which white supremacy has hurt everyone in society. And the third thing is to come out with some deep abiding commitment to not only critique the world, but also to critique oneself in terms of how we manifest it every day in society. I do not, and that does not mean that we want to take, see, I don't want to go back in history or even today and take every white person out and destroy their jobs and bring them down for every racist remark that they've made. That is not justice, that's vengeance. Hopefully we will, and that doesn't recognize that racism is systemic and none of our hands are clean. Even people of color internalize racism, so none of our hands are clean. So that kind of scorched earth policy only recreates and reproduces this death-driven moral nihilism that is a part that we are socialized into every day. So hopefully people come out with an understanding of what does it mean when systems of oppression are systematized, and it's larger than what individuals do. Whether you're a good person, whether or not I'm a good person, does not eradicate the presence of systemic evils.
I'm curious as to your, you touched on this at the beginning of our conversation, but where we are now, what is your level of optimism? It seems like such a dark time, and it seems like, especially in when it comes to the conversation that you're having and we're having this morning, it seems as though it is a difficult time. Of course, you have faced many other difficult times and have been there since almost the beginning of that civil rights movement. So I'm curious as to what you make of this time and if anything, where we can see some optimism.
Well, I think Martin Luther King reminded us that no lie lives forever, that the moral arc of the universe bends towards justice, and truth crushed to the ground shall rise again. And in our own historical recollections, there was once an empire that bragged that the sun did not rise or set on its territories. And that empire is a pale wisp of itself today. And we know that empire as the Great Britain. Colonialism shows us that empires fall. What we should learn from history, that just because an empire falls, it doesn't mean that it stays fallen unless we are creating ways to sustain the territory that we've gained. So I don't see us as caught up in a web of nihilism where we cannot change our lives. I also see it in the ways in which people are rising up in different communities over the question of the tax scam, where people rose up against health care, where more than a million women converged on Washington to call the question on certain issues of justice. All around us, we see movement and motion. The problem is that it's diminished, its significance is diminished by the media because it remains invisible. Secondly, we are inundated with an immediate gratification view of the world that, for example, if we engage in a direct action that does not yield what we want, then we think that we fail without looking at the fact that we succeeded by bringing 5,000 people out to demonstrate. So I think that we have to begin to rethink how we analyze the impact and the presence of our power in the world today.
And so forgive me for this, but I'm just going to go back one more. But so where is the optimism?
I am a living embodiment of that optimism.
Absolutely.
The mere fact that we're sitting here today, the mere fact that as a black person, I was never meant to survive in this country. And as Sterling Brown, the black poet, said that no matter how much they hemmed us in ghettos, no matter how much they lynched us, no matter how much they economically starved us, a strong people kept coming. And so that I think that we can look around us, even with immigrants who've been taught to walk away, to erase from their consciousness the class oppression that existed in Europe. The mere fact that they were able to come to a country and build a new life for themselves is a stronghold of hope. So we see hope all around us. The reason why we're not hopeful, because we've been socialized in a society that feeds on our fear and our despair. And even when we've managed to achieve an outstanding victory, they have so warped our perceptions that we reduce it to nothing. And so that I think Howard Zinn was onto something when he said that hope lies in understanding the people's history and recognizing the many achievements that ordinary people have done in this country, the abolitionist movement, the labor movement, the LGBTQ movements, all of the movements that have happened in this society. And I think one of the things that the Republicans have done with the Southern strategy is that they not only waged war against black people, they waged war against the Northeastern liberal establishment, which had been the bedrock of social movements in this country. And even liberals began to internalize the Republican message about the weakness of liberals in this country. And so that I think that there is hope everywhere if we're willing to look at history and to find those lights, the points of light in the history of ordinary people.
Ruby Sales, we are out of time. I'm so sorry, but thank you so much for being with us. You can find out more information at rowcenter.org.